gentleman there. Today, I'm releasing an audit of the American economy that's been prepared by my advisors that I described to this nation in the address last week. And this audit confirms that the economy of the United States needs a profound and dramatic change in direction. There can no longer be a business-as-usual approach. Inflation and unemployment are threatening the American way of life as never before, and without a change of policy, these intolerable conditions will get even worse. This audit also suggests a sense of urgency, that we must halt the growth of government and the corresponding burden of overspending, taxation, and regulation before they irreversibly alter the character of this nation. We're still the most productive people in the world, living in a nation with a potential that staggers the imagination. I'm confident with the facts before them, the American people will understand the need for the changes that we'll propose next week. And this audit shows us that our actions must put the nation on a fundamentally different course. Now, I am due 5 minutes ago down at the Lincoln Memorial, so I am going to leave you now, but I am leaving you in the hands of Murray Wiegenbaum, who can take all of your questions and explain this audit report to you, which I understand is going to be made available or already has been made available to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you. The purpose of this audit is to present the key facts and figures on the economic situation that President Reagan inherited. It shows that although the economy has in the past suffered either high inflation or high unemployment, what is unique today is the combination of sustained high inflation and sustained high unemployment. We show that the basic source of most of our economic distress is the policies of government itself over the course of many previous administrations. Nevertheless, the fundamental strength of the private enterprise economy still shows through the dismal current statistics. To tap into this nation's productive economic base requires a commitment to reduce tax and regulatory burdens and to increase incentives for working and saving. The economy's various economic difficulties are closely interrelated. Any attempt to solve one, such as inflation, without taking the other, such as unemployment, into account, is doomed to failure. In fact, it is the stop-and-go economic policies of the past that have been a major source of the problem. A comprehensive solution aimed at the entire range of economic ills now facing the United States is required. That is the highlights, the essence of this economic presentation. I will be glad to take your questions.
All right, so I'm going to say to use this audit for a speech of February 5th, and it's dated February 6th.
The audit was made available to him in terms of the reproduction of the charts and tables. The printed version was prepared at a later date, but this is the material prepared for the president.
Mr. Wiegenbaum, are you revising upward your forecast for inflation for a year from now?
The president on February 18th will present the details of his economic program, and either as part of the message or as part of the official backup, we will be presenting the economic forecast, the economic scenario, the economic projections on which the revenue and expenditure estimates are based. At that time, I will be delighted to explain, analyze, and defend our economic assumptions with great
Is the story wrong, then, that you have revised upward your forecast for both unemployment and inflation?
I am neither confirming nor denying the variety of rumors on the subject. What I am saying is we have been involved in a very serious, extended effort to develop a useful, reasonable, realistic, consistent set of economic assumptions. In this day of computer age, of course, a variety of staff studies, estimates, alternatives were available. You may have seen some of those staff estimates. However, there is only one set of numbers which will be the basis for the president's February 18th message. And when those numbers are released, I say I will be glad to explain those set of numbers in any detail.
Well, the general expectation, Mr. Wiedenbaum, that the very optimistic numbers quoted by supply-side economists Kumlow and Rutledge are not likely to be the basis for the president's forecast?
On the positive side, let me say that the numbers that you will see will have a very strong imprint of the Council of Economic Advisers and the other key economic advisors of the Reagan administration. And you are free to, frankly, draw whatever conclusion you want from any of the preceding informal staff studies or suggested alternatives. There is only one set of economic assumptions. And I say when they are presented on February 18th, you can have that be as completely as you like.
I have questions. Number one, has that decision been reached? And number two, how much flexibility are you going to do in reaching that decision?
I'm not sure if I follow.
How wide a range do you have to look at and make the decision on the assumption?
Oh, you appreciate inevitably, and I say this as a veteran economic forecaster, there are always a variety of estimates from a variety of sources, and there's nothing different in the current situation.
If there is such a wide range of forecasts for the course of inflation and under the months ahead, why should the country have particular confidence in the ones that you will release on February 18th?
For a very specific reason. The numbers that we will have in our forecast are based on the adoption of President Reagan's economic program.
We've had these figures in one form or another in the last month or so. To add impact to it, if nothing else, why wouldn't you share with us your projections, not what you're going to do as a program, but what you see for the future of a fairly fundamental in the same ground?
If I interpret the question as, shall I scoop the president, I will frankly decline that opportunity. I will, of course, be delighted to explain, analyze, answer your questions about this economic audit that we are releasing this morning.
Thank you. When you spoke to us today, you indicated in stressing economic growth as a key factor, not the balance budget and self-sufficient credit growth, that you see a distinction, and you said that maybe you're agreeing with me, between credit creation that goes towards economic growth and credit creation that's purely inflationary. Is that a major factor in your determining this program?
I don't recall using the term credit creation. What I did point out very strongly, and it certainly comes across in this economic audit, is that the nation is faced with the twin evils of high inflation and high unemployment. That comes through loud and clear in all of the tables and charts, as well as text, and therefore the need for a comprehensive program that does simultaneously deal over a period of time with expanding the rate of economic growth and reducing the high level of inflation. In fact, one of the things my staff has done since the preparation of this audit is to provide some detail on the question of how unusual is this combination of inflation and unemployment. And one of the things I did was to rely on the work of one of my distinguished predecessors as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, the late Arthur Oaken. If you recall, Dr. Oaken developed something called the Misery Index. President Reagan, during the campaign, referred to the Misery Index on occasion. That is the combination of inflation and unemployment. And you, I can report that in 1960, for example, the misery index, the combination of inflation and unemployment, stood at 7.4%. In 1980, it stood at 17.5%. Quite clearly, a very substantial, and the intervening years certainly demonstrate that, we have had in this two-decade period, that's a very frankly, over a variety of administrations, we've had a very substantial increase in this combined index, which focuses neither exclusively on inflation nor unemployment, but on both. The president will provide specific details on revenues, expenditures, and the targeted elimination of the budget deficit.
He will tell it by year.
Yes, ma'am. First of all, a very comprehensive, across-the-board effort to reduce government spending. Again, I'm not in a position to upstage the president and release the details of the budget cuts. Will every region of the country, will every group of the society feel those budget cuts? Yes, ma'am. However, every group of the society, every part of the country will also bear the benefits of the reduced inflation and reduced unemployment, so that over the five-year period for which these numbers extend, I believe you truly will see that the average citizen will be better off, that the gain from the expansion of the economy, the gain from the reduction of inflation will far more than offset whatever temporary hurt is achieved from the budget cuts. First of all, every one of these numbers that we are using is cited from standard official governmental statistics. But I urge you to consider the opening point I made. We have had, and clearly the depression in the 1930s is a compelling example, we've had sustained periods of high unemployment before. We've had sustained periods of high inflation before. What's so unique about the economic distress facing the United States now is simultaneously, and that is the unique economic distress, high inflation plus high unemployment. Do I dispute the present statement that the average American is worse off? No.
Other indicators, such as real disposable income, which calculates per capita income after tax and after inflation, is about 75% higher than it was 20 years ago.
Now, quite clearly, the president's relying on a battery of statistics, not on one isolated number, and frankly, on more something far more important, in my personal estimation, and that is the outlook for the American economy, the very sour outlook on the basis of pre-existing policy.
Are there indicators that show that the connected are better off?
I think it's quite clear from a variety of sources, including a variety of in-depth public opinion polls, that the American public does not have a sense of, on the basis of the pre-existing policy, of a positive outlook for the future.
We are watching biometric indication of standard of living, which is the central economic issue. How much income people have is irrelevant. In fact, after inflation, Americans own more and spend more and have more and have a higher standard of living than 20 years ago. How can you say that's irrelevant to the assessment of whether or not they're better off?
I call your attention to chart 20, which shows the decline in real weekly take-home pay in $1972. These are the Labor Department's own numbers. And you can see the decline in recent years in real weekly take-home pay. This is one of several measurements that I suggest. Again, remember, it is a battery of indicators. It is a variety of evaluations that I have relied upon in making my report to the President.
The standard of living shows it better than 1965.
There, you've seen since 1965, first stagnation and then decline, so that.
Support the statement that Americans are worse off. It's not an opinion poll. It's not an economic test. It's not even a chart which does not show that.
Oh, it's not a literary index that does show that. It shows it dramatically. And we'll be glad to make that available to you. And as a concept that, as very frankly, was, as I point out, and I'm sure it's well known, was not developed in this administration, but developed by economists identified who served in the position I hold in the preceding administration.
Well, yeah, one related question. Do you concede that there is a section of the population, mainly people on the lower income scale, who are better off than they were in 1960?
If you disaggregate the numbers sufficiently, will you come across individual members of the American society who are better off?
Yes.
If you look at the range of the American economy, if you leave Washington and travel, as I did on the lecture circuit before joining the government, you will see real physical evidence of serious economic distress. Whether it's in the Midwest or in other parts of the nation, quite clearly, the most visible measures of economic distress, I think, are in those unemployment charts, which are also included here. But perhaps it's not the raw numbers. Perhaps looking at the key regions of this country who are no longer growing, but have suffered stagnation, and many who have suffered decline, that the economic distress we are talking about and that we are determined to move away from is a very real situation. Incidentally, the year I believe you asked me for, my hope is 1984. Not 1984 with no apologies to George Orwell. That's my personal hope.
Your personal hope for inflation. The question I have
is zero inflation. That's reasonable.
What do you think inflation will be next year if the Reagan policies are carried out?
We will get the specific set of numbers.
Today, the independent agencies on the cutback. You seem to confirm,
I did not. I've been, as you know, an active member of the Budget Review Group, and on that basis, I've been pleased to report on the overall results. But I have not, and I scrupulously avoided commenting on the budget proposals for individual departments.
Are they all going to play dead today again? Is everybody
going to
accept all this?
I must say, I find very heartening the extent to which the departmental secretaries have taken the leadership in the budget restraint efforts.
Independent agencies as well.
But we said at least one official economic focus was in the stretch. The 3 to 5 cent gallon increase in the school results of the president's order to keep in oil. Will that estimate scrap the reliability of your forecast expectations?
I am not aware of, I have not released any numbers, any forecasts of price movements. At this point, I am not preparing and I am not presenting price forecasts. As you recall, when the price decontrol announcement was made in this room, I stated I expected that gasoline prices in the United States by the end of the year would be where they would have been if the original decontrol schedule had been I think you should carefully examine the numbers I've given. In other words, which are simply in terms of where we will be at the end of the year.
Where will we be? What you're saying is we'll be in October there anyway.
That is precisely the point I made. I did not present a numerical forecast.
Well, your colleague did, and Stockman gave out 3 to 5. I'm also part of the administration.
Yes, and I'm sure they can speak for themselves and do very eloquently. If you have a question about any statement I've made, I will explain it in detail. If you have a question about Mr. Stockman, I suggest you ask him one day.
Are you saying that government deficits are
always No, I'm saying that government deficit spending on and off budget deficits are a major cause of financing. The rapid expansion in the costs of complying with government regulation surely are another important element of inflation. The kind of monetary policy we've had in the past, the unpredictable, erratic, often rapid growth in the money supply, surely has been a fundamental contributor in the past to the inflationary problems. As we state in the audit, increases in energy prices or in food prices or anchovy problems in 1973-74 are what economists call transitory shocks. They do not have a fundamental effect on the underlying rate of inflation. It's monetary and fiscal policies, government policies, which are the basic factor explaining the high rate of inflation.
Would these transitory shocks explain why some people who are actually better off than they were in 1960 today feel that they're worse off?
Not being a practicing psychologist, I'll have a little difficulty responding, but when I... Quite clearly, and we demonstrate in great detail in this audit that those high interest rates, which are primarily the result not only of current high inflation, but of expected future high inflation, that those interest rates are another factor causing a great deal of economic distress. Very frankly, on the basis of my meetings and meetings of my colleagues with a variety of interest groups that have come to the White House during the course of our developing these programs, business, labor, farmers, mayors, governors, my and my colleagues' visits with members of the Congress, both sides of the aisle, I feel a very strong public support for the President's program, that is, both for the tax reductions and the expenditure reductions. There's a growing realization that it is that deficit financing that is a major factor. It's that rapid growth in government spending that's a major factor for the inflation, and that the country will be better off from the adoption of this program. I'm optimistic that we have never had as good an opportunity as we have today to slow down the rapid growth of government spending. Therefore, I see a more optimistic future, very frankly, for the United States. I can ask that in the first of all, in my own studies on regulation, I'm convinced that the effective burden of regulation is much higher here than it is in most other nations, because the burden isn't just the dollars of cost of compliance, but the great uncertainty involved in that very extended process whereby regulation is imposed, whereby permits are or may be after a very extended period of time awarded. And that uncertainty has a tremendous negative effect on new projects in a variety of industries, with energy being the most obvious, so that the hidden costs of regulation, the cost on the impacts on innovation, on capital formation, and you know I've written on this subject very widely, in great detail, that the regulatory burden in this country is far greater. That is, to me, very clear.
Regulation is a trade-off and benefit, do they not?
Now, I don't want to dwell exclusively on the subject of regulation. For example, if you look at the growth in the money supply in Germany, West Germany, and Japan, you will see that it has been much more modest than it has been in the United States. Why has the growth in the money supply been more modest? On the contrary, the growth in the money supply is influenced, is subject to the jurisdiction, the decision-making of the independent Federal Reserve System. And I think you need to look at the policy decisions by the Federal Reserve System for much of
the
as an economist, I strongly believe that the emphasis should be very properly on controlling the growth of the money supply and not on what we used to call money market conditions. Over the years in the past, the failure to give adequate attention to the growth in that often excessively rapid growth in money supply has been a very serious part of the inflationary problem, but there's enough blame to go around. Those large budget deficits, including off-budget financing, which it is under jurisdiction of the Congress and the executive branch of the government, often have forced the Federal Reserve System into that position.
Mexico, April 27th, 28th. There's a first-rail announcements that we'd like to put on the air.